Okay, you were talking about the Beach's lab and how things started to click.
Right. And after I come back from the interview with David Beach, and I also got a phone call from Tony Hunter at the Salk Institute, and also invited me to interview. And I want to go to his lab too. He was also doing a cell cycle, and then Tony was great. And from that point on, actually, to my career, still pretty supporting nowadays.
Right.
But he just called about a few days too late. He was at the Europe for a meeting, didn't get to see my application until he returned from Europe. I think it was 2 or 3 days, just I said yes, accepted the offer from Beach Lab. Yeah, so I didn't return to California for interview with Tony again.
Right. Yeah. So it sounded like you had a lot of different routes you could go.
I could. Nice. And I had help from two people in terms of making choice, two extra people actually. And before I decided where to go for interview, I had a long conversation and with several faculties in my department, the Rochester. So I went to talk to my chairman, and I did the first rotation. So that time he realized he made a mistake not to keep me in his lab.
Right.
And, so he realized he didn't spend enough time with me, so we don't know each other on the first rotation. But anyway, and he was so helpful, so supporting all me on this. So he closed the office, okay, let's talk. What do you want to do? And then I said, I don't know what I want to do, and I really want to just hear. That was something not everybody's doing still, and they are not taking a step back nowadays when they graduate, and they just make a decision pretty quickly, mm-hmm. not have enough thought. Now I think I did something, and not everybody was doing this, and I really go around and talk to the number of people as I could, and get as much advice as I could, and try to have a more broad view. Somehow I realized subconsciously that I didn't have an overview about today's biomedical research. And I do know one thing, I will not continue open in Tom's lab as a postdoc. I want to go out, I want to get more training.
Right.
That's what's pretty clear. I didn't know what I want to do. So I took an initiative, contacted the faculties in the department, asking them to give me advice. And they were so happy to see that, because now everyone do that.
Mm-hmm.
And plus the fact that I did pretty well as a grad student. So they were happy to see and to sit down with me, to go through with me what they're thinking. So I talked to my chairman, and he closed his office door and listed 5 or 6 areas that he thinks is really emerging as a very hot areas that a lot of breakthrough likely will be made in the next few years that as a postdoc should join in.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is a cell cycle. The other is a tumor suppression. That's what I've been doing up to now.
Right.
And I also talked to Bob Anger, my wife's advisor. We're both looking for postdocs. We graduated at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So he was even more serious, and he saw about a few seconds, and he said, okay, and so why don't you come to our house and tomorrow for dinner? And I don't know how many students can have that. I don't even know how many faculty are doing that nowadays.
Right.
And he would invite us, just 2 of us, and send the kids out, just 4 of us, him, his wife, he's also a scientist, they both trained at Caltech, and my wife and myself, just 4 of us,
yeah.
And have dinner, and just after dinner, we have coffee and sitting in front of the fire, and talking the whole night, what he think and what the field would be good, and what I might be good, what I may not be enjoying, not much.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps me a lot.
Right.
At the end of that, the Bruce Albert and the Keith Yamamoto, and the two very prominent scientists in the biomedical field, went to Rochester for the funeral of their friend. So my chairman told me that's a good opportunity to grab them. So they both, and from different angles, they both are working on the different field.
Mm-hmm.
They know more than we do, because they are involved not only in their own research, they are involved in more broad areas, because Bruce Albert became the president of the National Academy of Science later, and the Keith Yamamoto was the chairman of the study section for years. They both know more than, even more broad. I never met them.
Mm-hmm.
So Marty said, don't worry about it. Just go them, just tell them and you are looking for a poster, and I bet you they'll be happy to talk to you if
right.
they have time. Okay, don't be shy. So I took that advice, and I just drive to the airport, and I told them before they land that they to board the flight, and for about half an hour. So they gave me specific suggestions and where I should go, and if I pick this area, and where I should not go. Actually, that's
mm-hmm.
a very frank discussion, and what some people first met. I'm really grateful for them for that
yeah.
part. So that actually gave me a lot of help for what I'm going, and make me feel confident going to cell cycle field, even though I didn't know anything about it, and
mm-hmm.
it was the right choice.
So you thoroughly researched all of this.
I did.
It sounds like
I did.
Some great
and
advice.
Yeah, And that's one thing, I don't know how to get started, but that's one thing and I took the initiative myself. And the first thing I did is looking for the publications in the last few years on the major journals like Nature, Science, and the Cell to see what areas are very hot and who is making a lot of contributions.
Right.
And I come with a list. So when I put together all these researches, I did it myself or from the conversation I had. And so that decision go to the Cold Spring Hub Lab was not too difficult ones.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So this brings us up to, what, May of 1990 then?
Right.
When you enter Cold Spring Harbor in the Beach Lab. What was it like entering that laboratory? Describe that. First of all, I guess, what was David Beach like? What was your relationship with him?
It was not as close as I had with Tom Eckbush.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so David was young. He's only 4 years older than I am.
Oh, wow.
Right. He was very famous already. When that young, that's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Not very personal. Very intense.
Right.
Incredible smart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's how he can be described. And even up to now, I don't have close relationship with him. Yeah, which I could and I should, but I didn't.
Right.
Yeah. And I tried. Well, I did try very hard. It's just not easy. And he was very busy. And at the peak, when I was there, he had 25 posters.
Wow.
And occupied the entire floor of 30 plus people.
That's crazy.
Including himself and the secretary and the supporting technicians.
Right.
And was running very robust research and in the cell cycle field. It was incredibly productive and make all these important discoveries. Right. And then, so his schedule was so tight, and so it's difficult to get time to really get personalized. I don't think he was personalized with any particular person for a real long time. And that's just his personality.
Right.
Yeah. So when I first got into David Beach Lab, and then the first feeling I have is, boy, this is a great place. How well can I do here?
Mm-hmm.
And you feel, it's unlike the experience I had when I went to Tom's lab. It was small. You get to know everybody in 1 week pretty well. It's only four of us,
right,
including the technician, besides Tom. But the time when I arrived in the Beach Lab, I already have a dozen people already. And most of postdocs, there's only one or two grad students.
Mm-hmm.
In a very competitive environment. And it's not easy to get along with everybody so quickly. And you just feel you're pretty junior.
Yeah.
And so it takes time to adjust. My first 6 months was not very relaxed, was not very happy. And it's completely different environment from Rochester, where I had such an intimate relationship with everybody in the lab. And that was not the case at the Cold Spring Hub Lab.
No.
Beach Lab for the first 5 months, everybody just walking alone. On top of that, the lab was expanding in an incredible pace. Every month, we would have, or 2 months at the most, we would have a new person join the lab.
Mm.
And once in a while, we see a new person, we don't know who this is. We don't know somebody just come to borrow a reagent or someone and is your poster mate. Was never formally introduced. We can't remember who is coming to give a seminar, who joined the lab. Just keep on coming, and just always new people come in.
Right.
And that was a period that was pretty crazy at the time. Yeah, and the Dale just got a huge money. The lab was expanded. The lab was so crowded because the space was behind. The completion of the new building was behind the schedule. So we're crunched like 10 people in a very small room. And you can hardly just physically walking around in the lab. So it was very stressed at the beginning. Yeah. So that's the beginning of the lab. Yeah.
So it took about maybe 6-7 months then to adjust to these new conditions.
Right. And take probably that long for me to adjust to that environment. And I also did not have a very high confidence at the beginning because I don't know who else doing what. It's completely blank. And also few people was not having training in the genetics because his lab at the time, the main project was on the genetics of cell cycle using a model organism called the yeast.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know anything about it. And I got a feeling a lot of people had the yeast training as a grad student. That was one thing I was afraid of going to fly lab. I said, like, going there like an idiot and don't know anything or know so much less. I thought, I'm just enter another environment, even though I know that the learning user genetics is much less complicated than learning Drosophila genetics. But still, you just feel that you know much less than everyone else. You just have to work harder to get know those. And the first project in the David Lab didn't work out, actually. So my first project is completely was not failed. We now know why. I was assigned the project to isolate or screen for a tyrosine kinase gene in Palm Beach East.
Mm-hmm.
The time the kinase gene was, tyrosine kinase was very hard, was identified as a the major oncogenic pathway in the mammalian cells. And it's multi-gene family. The PCR technique just coming out that we could use in the sequence alignment of human tyrosine kinase to design so-called the degenerate oligo to screen and the possible candidate of yeast tyrosine kinase. So that's my project. That's my first project. And I'm working and working and trying to try to just, phew, there's nothing I couldn't pull out. Completely failed. We now know there was no tyrosine kinase in Pompe at all.
Right.
Yeah.
By the way.
And so so that's one of the things I have been researching. You never know. Then you just keep on thinking that the condition was not good, and you keep on modifying. And they finally give up.
Right.
Finally give up.
Now, and when you finally gave up, though, was it your decision, or was it Beach walking over and saying?
I think it was David's decision.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't remember specifically. And we had a discussion. Then he said, okay, let's stop it. But that was an evolving process, and it just couldn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
It's overlapping with another project, and so sometimes the decision drops something, and is made by the good progress of another project. It's okay, that's going very well. Why don't you focus on that? Which means stop on this one, right? So that's the project was and got me into the cell cycle field. So the project is to isolating the yeast cycling genes, or more specifically, using a genetic approach to isolating G1 cycling of mammalian cells. So, and the background is pretty simple. So that was a year that in the Steve Reed's lab at the Scripps and the Bruce Fuchs lab at the Cold Spring Harbor lab report three genes from yeast. They call it CLIN1, CLIN2, and CLIN3. It's a cycling protein.
Mm-hmm.
If you knock out, which means you remove the function of any one of those three genes or any two of those genes, there was no problem for yeast to grow. But if you simultaneously knock out all three, the yeast won't grow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, won't grow means they stopped in the cell cycle, which we call the cell cycle rest, and they stop at a specific point of the cell cycle called the G1 point of the cell cycle. So they got a name called the G1 cycling, and that's important. That's very important because if we are thinking that cancer as a disease of cell cycle, one can see that cancer is pretty much a disease of a deregulated cell cycle. Because in a sense, the cancer is a group of cells that just keep on growing, they're dividing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't stop their cycle. Because 95% of cells in our body right now, they don't grow. They stay there as a live cell doing their job, but they are not supposed to keep on dividing. Only two types of cells keep on dividing all the time. One is a germ cell. And why is cancer cells?
Mm-hmm.
So a hallmark of a cancer cell is a so-called immortalized. They keep on dividing.
Right, the difference.
Indefinitely. So the concept is pretty simple, that if we can understand how the normal cell cycle is controlled, we might understand how the tumor cell developed. So the idea has been there for a long time. The focus has been early on, even before I got into the Cold Spring Harbor lab, focusing on understanding the G1 part. Because cell cycle can be divided into four phases. Okay, one phase is actually divide from one cell into two.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another period that replicate all the DNA called the S phase, during which all the genetic material, DNA, and the copied or duplicate from one to two. But then before the mitosis, the cell take a break of the finished DNA synthesis. So we now know why. It's because they want to make sure all the DNA have been replicated. Check one time.
Oh, I see.
And then when everything's fine, they commit the mitosis, divide. After mitosis, they don't initiate DNA synthesis right away. They also take a break, or we call the gap phase, called a G1. So that's the time we now know is incredibly important, because that's the period of time cell measuring the environmental condition. And that includes like cell differentiation, DNA damage, cell senescence, so on and so forth,
mm-hmm.
to make a decision whether to go on to replicate DNA and divide or to arrest. Because all the cells in our body, if they arrest in the G1. They don't arrest in the G2. Cell cannot stop in the middle of DNA replication or middle of mitosis. They will die if they do that.
Hmm.
Right? So for example, the neuronal cells are all G1 cells, which means when I finish mitosis, they receive the signal, now you're supposed to become a neuron. Right? So you will stop forever to divide. Just stay as a G1 cells.
Right.
Okay? And if the neuron cells divide, we are not going to have any memories. So muscle cells differentiate. And so the G1 phase become fused. And each cell has multiple nuclei. So of course, they cannot divide anymore. Right? So they do that during the G1 phase of the cell cycle. Okay, more importantly, back to 1989, or late 1980 or early 1990, and the study from the oncogene transformation have come to realization that a lot oncogene function during G1 phase of the cell cycle. So this, if you look in when they express, when they have activity, they all function G1, because those are the signaling molecules determining whether the cell to divide or to rest.
Mm-hmm.
So it is in that context make everybody realizing if we can identify the G1 cyclin, the cyclin was already known to be necessary for cell to move on to the next phase, to divide. But there are a lot of different cyclins, some responsible for mitosis, some for DNA replication, but G1 cyclin was not identified. If we can identify G1 cyclins, they might carry direct connection to oncogenesis.
Right.
So that's the stage. And Steve Reed's lab and Bruce Fletcher's lab and the time identified the G1 cycle in the yeast. Of course, yeast don't get cancer, but mm-hmm. the implication is pretty clear that we might take the genetic system to look in for gene for mammalian cells with functional complement the yeast G1 cycling deficiency.
Right.
So in other words, we could ask in whether we can transform those yeast cells that is deficient for all three cyclins with a mammalian cDNA library, thereby isolating the gene that can complement G1 cyclin deficiency. By definition, that's a mammalian G1 cyclin.
Mm-hmm.
So we could have a mammalian G1 cyclin, so we could have a first insight into cancer development, how that is being connected to the cell cycle. So that was an unspoken implication to many people involved in the field. And then, I don't know what's so clear or not, but I think that was the impression in a lot of people's mind. That if somebody can identify the G1 cyclin, that could allow us to have the first insight how the cell cycle control is being deregulated in during the cancer development.
Right.
Because at that time, there were a lot of cell cycle genes already identified, such as CDC2 and the cyclin B. But quickly, it was realized that those genes are very unlikely to be targeted during the oncogenesis, because it doesn't matter your tumor cells or your normal cells. They all need to divide once they start replicating DNA. Okay, tumor cell need those ones, so that's a normal cell. Okay, so to change the activity of those genes is not any beneficially
mm-hmm.
for the tumor cells. Well, the tumor cell become tumor, or cancer cell become cancerous, it's not because they are dividing any faster. It's not because they're proliferating faster than normal cells. That's not the case. The reason they become cancerous is because they are capable of dividing at the time when the normal cell would not, or supposed not.
Mm-hmm.
They were capable of proliferating or they entering the cell cycle at a place when the normal cells when normal cells would stop. So in other words, it's not much faster. Okay, just like if you're driving too fast, you can kill somebody. But mm-hmm. instead, you're not stopping in the red light, and you're not watching around. So you bump into somebody's car.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was more or less and the idea in a lot of people's mind back in 1990, that if we can understand the G1 control, we might identify the decision-making cell cycle genes, which conceptually, if consistently or always on, the cell keep on dividing, they
right.
don't arrest, the consequence is cancer.
So yeah. Starting from those assumptions then.
Right. So from the assumptions, I was joining the project. I did not initiate the project. I was joining the ongoing project and mm-hmm. By another postdoc using that approach to identify a G1 cyclin in the pumping, which is separate yeast. That was the organism studied by David Beach for years. So I joined in to use the same approach but looking for a same type of gene but from mammalian cells.
Right.
And so one post was focusing on identifying the yeast at the pumping G1 cyclin. I was working on the mammalian cyclins. G1 cyclins using mm-hmm. same approach. And so we're working on that one, and so we took this system, and we did a lot of transformation of the recipe experiment, and then identified and several new genes, and that was starting sequencing those genes. And I remember when one day when David came back from a meeting, he said, "What do you got?" I said, "I sequenced new cycling genes." So we look at that, we couldn't make it much, because that gene itself is clearly a cyclin. Mm-hmm. But doesn't look like the G1 cyclin we were expecting. Using the only G1 cyclin we know of was a clean 1, 2, and a 3 from yeast. But the gene I pulled out called a cyclin, which the gene we now call cyclin D. Okay? It doesn't look like a real G1 cyclin more than any other cyclin we know of.
Right.
So just by the sequence comparison, we can't tell what's a G1 cyclin or not. We are not short of cyclin at the time. We're just focusing on the G1 cyclin. So this gene is capable of complement G1 cyclin deficiency. But so can other mitotic cyclin. So that mm-hmm. was one surprise, is that even though those three genes, clean 1, 2, 3, are clearly only functioning the G1, and without their function, the yeast cannot go through G1, will stop. But if you ectopically provide a cyclin which normally don't function G1, instead in G2, it can do the same job.
Right.
So we didn't realize that. So just by virtue of its ability of capable of rescuing the G1 cyclin deficiency, it doesn't prove the cyclin D is G1 cyclin. And by locking the sequence, it doesn't look any particular closer to the G1 cyclin of yeast than other mitotic cyclin we know of. So we were not so sure what we got of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we put it in the refrigerator. So keep on looking for, hoping that we can pull the gene that really look like the cyclins. So I continue working on and couldn't get any new cyclins. Couldn't. So and then we just, one day we decided we go back to working on the cyclin genes that we still have the name yet.
Mm-hmm.
And they're working on this, and then things start moving very fast from that point. So one day and they come back from the meeting at the Howard Hughes, and he stood next to the person called Chuck Scher at the Memphis, and they were working on a totally different angle, and working on a receptor genes called a CSF. It's a gene that is necessary for a mouse cell lines called the macrophage to progress through the G1 phase.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't provide that growth factor, they will stop in the G1. If you add in the growth factor, they will now go to the S phase. So they want to know what that growth factor is doing by looking for the target. So they did a pretty straightforward experiment and made the two CDN libraries, and the one with and the one without the growth factor stimulation, asking what's different in terms of gene expression, and the part of three genes. And when the sequence, it looks like cyclin. They don't know what cyclin is. They simply call it cyclin-like molecules,
right.
1, 2, and 3. And so they both met on the bus, and that's David told me, and they're talking about it. And so, David, you're from Cosmic Home Lab, you work on a cell cycle.
Mm-hmm.
He said, yeah. And so the Chuck started asking David some questions about the cell cycle and the cyclin. At the end, they said, well, and we cloned a new cyclin recently, and it has this characteristic, look like a G1 cyclin, but by sequence doesn't look like any particularly. Doesn't look like the G1 cyclin of yeast that we know of at that point. So when David returned, and they had a more phone conversation, they decided, let's compare the sequence side by side, which means my sequence, the one I put out, mm-hmm. and the Chuck's sequence. So they decided to fax each other at the same time, and the first few amino acids, and immediately we realized we got the same gene.
Right.
Yeah. So they know from our finding that is a cyclin by functional definition, because we pull the gene by functional rescue. And we know from their experiment the gene is being induced in the G1 phase. So put it together, smells very good as a G1 cyclin.
Right.
And so then we started cooking the paper together, and then they agreed we're going to submit our paper side by side and back to back to the same journal. So they had a gene and before we did, and so they graciously agreed that if their paper accepted, they'll be willing to wait for a few more weeks.
Oh, wow.
Delay the publication, mm-hmm. so that two papers can publish back to back, have more impact and easy for the people to read it.
Right.
And that was great, because we sit on the gene for several months, we're not working on it, because from the sequence comparison, we couldn't tell is a G1 cyclin or not. We're continuing working on the cyclin, we couldn't find it. So now we return work on the cyclins and did some basic characterizations, and we submit a paper back to back and to Cell, and both people was accepted. And at the same time, at the very same month, I believe, and there was another group at Harvard Medical School working on a totally different area of research. This is a specific cancer called the parathyroid cancer. And working on a subset of cancer, they realize have a specific translocation between a chromosome 11 and a chromosome 13. They know what is on the chromosome 13, where the gene moved on. Because on the chromosome 13 is a specific promoter that become very actively expressed in this tissue.
Mm-hmm.
So idea behind that is, and whatever gene from chromosome 11 somehow jump into the chromosome 13, into the promoter of the thyroid hormone, become now active. And that activation could contribute to development of this particular cancer, if they can find out what that gene is. Right? So they published a few papers early on, but they couldn't narrow down
right.
what the gene on the chromosome 11 is now fused during the cancer development to the this parathyroid hormone promoter on the chromosome 13. So eventually they narrow down and they clone the gene sequence cyclically. So they realize that they might have the first connection with the cancer directly. And they so they heard somehow our finding as well. So rushed the paper to Nature, and they actually ended up with a publish a couple of weeks earlier than our paper, and turns out to be identical genes.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. So that was a very exciting area and the time of period. And for the first time, we had a direct evidence that expression of a cyclin genes that is known to function during the cell cycle is activated during the G1 phase by growth factor and is translocated into during the development of a specific cancer. So that really provides the first evidence of a cell cycle gene being altered during the cancer development
right.
and fulfill the prediction that the cell cycle is a direct target. And it only take a couple of months then we realize we just touched the tip of iceberg, because the laydown immediately after the Nature paper, people realized the second D genes we all landed was located on this chromosome 11 Q13
mm-hmm.
is a site a lot of people been working on, because that's the area that area has been known for years and amplified in about 40% of head and neck cancer, 25% of breast cancer. Right? So when a gene is amplified, you're indicating presence of oncogenes. Okay? And isolation of cyclin genes and knowing the function in promoting cell cycle and the localization of the gene on the chromosome 11 Q13 and let those people quickly get to narrow down asking whether cyclin D is in that amplicon,
right.
is amplified in the breast cancer or not, is amplified in the head and the neck cancer or not. Answer is yes. Yeah. So cyclin D gene represents now a major marker for breast cancer development
mm-hmm.
as well as head and neck cancer.
So when did you publish this paper?
1991.
So yeah. It was very early on in the postdoc then.
Yeah, so that was very quick and it was incredible fast paced, and we can hardly get those figures together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the whole process of cooking that paper at the end, well, if you don't count the delay and continue looking for the gene that was not there, it's only take a couple of months.
Hmm.
Once we realize what we got to it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, could you, fairly quickly go through, what the research that you did after then, after 1991?
Yeah.
Before establishing your own lab.
Yeah. Well, after cloning whole cyclin D, I had a downtime for about 5 or 6 months. I couldn't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you got a cyclin, what you really found out is the kinase, because cyclin doesn't work by itself. It has to find a kinase. We couldn't find a kinase. And it just really going just
circles.
Yeah. Just going nowhere. The whole research, pretty downtime. And so the breakthrough came in 1992. And when I finally got a good new antibodies and found that cyclin D and associated with CDK2 and the CDK4 and the CDC2. But that was not a major finding. What the major finding was, and during that study, searching for the protein associated with cyclin D, I found that in addition to CDK that we were looking for, cyclin D also forming complex with two other proteins, one called PCNA, one called P21. So I'm not going to say much about the PCNA, we still don't know a whole lot of what PCNA is doing. There are a lot of studies on this one, but let me say a few words about P21, because that and has a lot of impact on my subsequent research.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a 21 kilodalton, we had no idea what it's doing. But we were really surprised already that cyclin forming complex, not just with CDK, but also with some other proteins, that finding it itself carries a lot of implication. Because at that point, and it was widely accepted, cyclin forming complex with CDK, and this is an enzyme, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a key enzyme controlling cell cycle. By virtue of physical association, pretty tight one, that the other protein like P21 and PCNA could play a key role in regulating this activity. So this was published in 1992 that we reported that the cyclin deforming complex with several CDKs as well as P21.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was the first report that cyclin and the CDK proteins can form a complex with additional proteins. And immediately followed that finding, and I published another paper in 1993, and that documenting that the P21 molecule was not associated with cyclin and the CDK if the cell is already transformed.
Mm-hmm.
So that really had quite a bit of impact to the field. And the way I made that discovery, I can take one credit, is that I was really thinking a lot about the genetics, thinking about the control. Because we were looking at the kinase complex, and we found this this association in a specific cell lines that people call the normal cells. I don't understand at the time why they call normal cells, not wild type cells. Later on, people tell me the human cells, you can't start a human in the body. You can take a cell culture, start in the plastic dish. They're not a wild type anymore, a lot of things changed. But the cell line I was using is as normal as one can get. They call the normal cells. That's normal cells like a wild type, as opposed to the cell line is happy from tumor cell lines. I was really into and talking to a lot of people, how could I have a control, just like people doing the genetics. When they're doing the genetics, they're comparing the wild type with the mutant. I want to do the same thing in the mammalian cells. People say there's no wild type of cells. This normal cells is all you can get. I said, well, how can you compare this? You cannot compare this, because whenever you talk about two human cell lines, and they always come from two different people, and they've been cultured totally differently, you're always comparing orange and apple. That's not comparable.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't like that idea. It's got to be comparable somehow. They said, well, and if you want to do this one, so you can take this so-called normal human cells, compare with the one derived from it, of the transformed by DNA tumor virus. So that's how I get into this. So compare the normal cells and its transformed derivative.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually, and they just dig in the golden pond.
Right.
Okay, and as soon as we run side by side, I realized a lot of things that happened to the cyclin CDK complex. Among them is the P21 molecule is lost when cells are transformed. And another thing is that we discovered another protein called the P16, which represents a major tumor suppressor right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that had a lot of impact and for the subsequent research. And one third of my lab up to now still working on those small genes.
Okay.
And later on, the gene was cloned. We call them CDK inhibitors. And that conceptually tells us in the biochemical, there's a group of genes that bind the CDK and then negatively regulate the activity of CDK, just in opposite of cyclin, which binds the CDK and activates it. There's a good analogy. If you think of the CDK as an engine for the car, so the cyclin functions like a gas, just pump the car to go. But if you just have gas in the engine, it's very dangerous to drive if the brake is not working, and the CDK inhibitor is like a brake.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And we also realize for the cancer development, the brake is much more likely to be hit during the cancer development, because cancer cells need a gas as well.
Right.
And you probably need more gas to drive too fast, but that's not how most accidents occur. Most accidents occur not because you're driving too fast, it's because you forgot to stop, or you cannot stop, or you're not paying attention when you're driving. The problem is that the brake was not hit. So brake is more likely the one being hit during the cancer development. So that could be more likely to be the direct target of cancer development.
Mm-hmm.
So that idea turned out to be the case.
Right.
And the CDK inhibitors, particular P16, is much more frequently mutated during the cancer development than cyclin genes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the last finding as postdoc was a discovery of the CDK inhibitor, P21 and the P16. And before I left the lab, I just cloned the gene for P21. So that was published in 1993 in the Nature, the journal called the Nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not clone the P16. And after I discovered, and after I left the lab, another person continued, and using yeast 2 hybrid method, and cloned the gene for P16. That was late 1993. So by the time I started here in 1993 and 4, the CDK inhibitor field started exploring. So I joined the Beach Lab in 1990, and when the cycling idea started coming out, so I left the lab, and we pretty much know what the cycling is doing. We discovered the new G1 cyclins, and that led to the discovery of CDK inhibitors. And so my research has from here been focusing on the CDK inhibitors.
Right. Okay. Great. When you come here, tell us a little bit about that transition. What other places did you look at, and what were the main reasons you came to?
I looked a few places, and probably the number of places I got a lot of interviews. Mm-hmm. And the research was very hot and very potential, but it was a little bit too potential. And the Java seminar I was given was in the early 1993. The P21, the pectin was not even isolated yet. And I can only describe those as a polypeptide, as a protein, mm-hmm. without being able to telling the audience what they are. I can tell them conceptually that could be important by virtue of the association, but we never had luck. What's that like? And they said, we cannot predict, and they actually would be CDK inhibitors. There was no indication they could.
Mm-hmm.
The CDK inhibitor word was not even come out during my interview.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And people realize there's a lot of potential, just not very clear. That's one thing. Second, and I was not preparing at all my interviews. So my interviews went pretty lousy.
Right.
And my job seminar, and then I did not know how to present a seminar. I never gave people introduction. I always thought that the people know exactly what I was doing, and I just need to jump into my result. I got a lot of people confused. But there are some places that I appreciate, and I got several offers, and from like Indiana, Yale, here, MD Anderson. I picked up these schools and for a number of reasons. And the one, and my wife also got a job here and as a research faculty. And the people here are very positive, very positive. And this area is very good. Both my wife and I really like these areas, because during my job interview, and I said to my wife, and if I go out looking for a job first and she come with me, then I'll try to look for the area that we both would like. Because we both don't like living in New York. I know I applied any place in New York or Los Angeles. Yeah. So that was not a good time for the American cities. And the mm-hmm. city was pretty dumb, and the crime was high, and was not a very nice time.
Yeah.
And since then, after we left, the New York City became much better. Yeah. So we don't like the big city life much. Yeah. And it didn't take me long to decide to come here. And when I finished the interview, and then as soon as I get back to Coast Medical Lab, they made an offer from here. So we would like to join our faculty.
Right.
And it only take like 2 or 3 weeks for me to decide to come and join
so
the faculty.
Yeah,
it's very quick.
Right.
It's very quick.
Now, your wife got the job before or after you got your job?
Before.
Before.
Yeah, before. Yeah.
Okay.
And they offered her a research faculty job at the Gene Therapy Center.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So she doesn't want to start her own lab like me to pursue an independent career. At that time, we had Jessie, my daughter, already. And she would like spend more time with the kids. And she, that time after completing her postdoc, she also did her postdoc at the Coast Medical Lab with another faculty, Nick Towns. She realized that she was not really enjoying that kind of intensive research, and they always worry about your grant, your publications, competitions.
Right.
She doesn't think she would enjoy that one. She decided not to pursue that kind of directions. Instead, a less independent job and would be more fit and from her perspective.
Right.
And there's a research faculty at the Gene Therapy Center, and is under supervision of another faculty, and she's responsible for managing vectors, but doesn't have too much responsibility.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And you might have told me this already, but when was your daughter born?
1990. Just before we left Rochester. And so when Jessie and when we moved to Coast Medical Lab, Jessie was 3 months old.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And what was the startup package like when you came here? What did they offer you?
It was decent. It was not incredible, outrageous big. And I think it was $250,000 cash. And I can use any way I wanted. Plus lab space, and my salary was paid by in the state of North Carolina, which means and I don't need to come up from the startup package. On top of that, and the Department of Biochemistry, where I got my tenure appointment, will support up to two grad students I was able to attract until I got my research grant. And the cancer center, which I got a joint appointment, will support a postdoc fellow, and I can recruit until I got my major grant,
mm-hmm.
which means and if I can recruit these people, I could start my lab right away, and even before I receive my R1 and grant from NIH. Yeah. So that was pretty decent at the time. Yeah, and it's not very best, but it's better than most other places. And they told me to really try hard to get me here. And
mm-hmm.
That was my last interview, and then I came to very close to making decisions, very close.
Right.
And they actually recognized this very significant part, because I was late in the 1993. The cell cycle stuff, the people start smelling that something's coming out.
Right.
And what they actually realized that the small molecules identified, like P21, P16, is the important ones. I'm not sure, because we couldn't appreciate them very well ourselves. But they can tell that just given what's happening in the cell cycle field in the previous year, involved in the cyclin D1 discovery, or G1 cyclin discovery, and the cancer, they realize that something is about to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. This is an interesting transition, because you're a student, you're a postdoc, and then you have to now set up your own lab, be a principal investigator, and you have a whole new slew of responsibilities and commitments. How was that transition for you?
Not very good.
No?
Yeah, no. I had no training, like everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so my first few years, and I was pretty much on the bench all by myself.
Right.
I really did not know how to train students. No one told me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I made a lot of mistakes. I drive them crazy. And I expect them working just like me. And the first three students I recruited, they were working just like me. They were very ambitious, and they worked incredibly hard. And then that's two words to describe them: ambitious and hardworking,
right.
Just like me. And I think I got them burned. I did not train them in the right way. But for the students that come in, they couldn't really appreciate as much as I could. And so if one doesn't really understand the implication of the study, it's difficult to ask them to appreciate working like that one. And besides, the pace was too intense for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I came out of Cold Spring Harbor Lab, and here's a different setting. I came out of the post on the incredible competitive. So that's not what they've been expecting. But they're working with me like that. And through the first couple of years, and they helped me to set up a lab. We published a few good papers. We got with their help. And I got my first two research grants. They both are very good ones, very big ones. And that was faster than any other people at the time, that the junior faculty submitted first two grants and got right away.
Yeah.
So that allowed me to really focusing on the research the next few years, and including additional fellowship from the Pew program. So that takes off very well. But as soon as I start recruiting a lot more people into lab and losing my hand on these three first batch of students, they almost get lost. Because I train them too closely, and I never really intentionally to let them to think about for themselves and to develop themselves. And there was too much on-hand training. That was not good for them.
Right.
And they lost the initiative. As soon as I lose my hand, they're just getting lost somehow. They're just a bit confused where they're going from that point. And they just feel all of a sudden, I don't care them anymore. They don't have enough attention anymore. So that I take a lot of responsibility for that. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
They did pretty well though. And my first student graduate, and after 3 years with me, published a few papers, got a very good job and moved on, and is now working in the bioinformatic industry.
Mm-hmm.
And they did very well now, still doing very well.
Right.
And but I think looking back, and even though she never told me, but I would say that she must have some distaste about the science research,
right.
Because of the intense. So my second student and went on in right now is in the medical school. He said he wants to do MD PhD type and clinical related research.
Mm-hmm.
But I think included in that thinking part is because the lab research probably got him burned somewhat. Yeah.
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 Okay. Well, why don't we leave it there, and we'll pick it up again, and we'll talk a little bit more about the lab. The personnel of your lab, and then also more general questions about the scientific community and your funding and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.